As usual, ahead of a budget or autumn statement, the rumours are flying around about what Chancellor of the Exchequer Jeremy Hunt will announce. Unusually this year, there are relatively few rumours about pension tax relief reform, but some of the rumours which have been persistent have been about the potential reform or simplification of ISAs and potential changes to inheritance tax. In 2023, there were 12 million ISA subscriptions, making them one of the most popular products in the UK. But are there too many of them? And if, as predicted, the government decides to cut IHT, what impact will this have? I'm Damien Fantato, Deputy Editor of FT Advisor. And with me to find out are Tom Selby, Head of Retirement Policy at AJ Bell, and Tim Morris, IFA at Russell & Co. Hello, both.
Hi, Damien.
Hi, Damien.
So, broadly speaking, Tom, is there a need for ISA reform in the autumn statement?
So, AJ Bell's been advocating for simplification of ISAs for a while. I wouldn't say there's need for fundamental reform to happen immediately at the autumn statement. So we've been pushing for long-term reform of ISAs and reform that's realistic. But the current situation that we have, where there are six different versions of ISAs introduced by different governments with slightly different aims and different allowances, is clearly not ideal. I think when you look at the pensions tax system, I think if you looked at the ISA system from a clean sheet of paper, nobody would design what we have at the moment. Our research suggests that level of complexity puts people off engaging with the product, and understandably so, because it's so difficult to know exactly which one's right for you. And it feels like now's a sensible time to look at that landscape, to try to simplify and hopefully create something that people find it easier to engage with, because at the moment it's far too difficult.
Tim, what do you think?
I totally agree with what Tom's saying there. So the beauty of ISAs has always been the fact that they're simple to understand. And so, to overcomplicate them, to get to the situation where we've got to, as Tom was saying, with these six different versions, is just crazy. And so, it's just stripping it back to what it was. Go back to the beauty of ISAs, just keep it nice and simple, easy to understand, and, just make sure more people have been encouraged to use them, as many people as possible continue to use them, because, a lot of people are at the moment, and let's keep it that way and make sure people are continuing to save and invest, and the easier the better.
Cool. I mean, one of the rumours that has been fairly persistent has been about the plans to relax ISA rules to allow savers to pay into more than one ISA in a tax year. Tim, staying with you, what do you think about this as somebody who, I guess, is involved in planning people's finances on a day-to-day basis?
Building on what I just mentioned, 70% of Brits, I was reading, know ISAs. In one of the latest reports, 50% of them know the different types. Only a third of them know the allowance, and having different allowances does confuse things. But what I really liked was, nearly a decade ago they introduced the NISA concept, new ISA, whereby it was meant to make things again a bit more simpler in terms of moving from cash to investments within an ISA, being able to switch from one to the other. And what's actually happened, what we've seen over the years though, is that more people have been moving to investments, and that could be because of the fact that was made easier. So, we saw a steady increase, from around about sort of 2016, where then we went from, around 80% in cash ISAs to more like, just over 60%. So there's a lot more shifting into investments, which is good. People probably have shifted back. That was as of last year, so they would have shifted back to cash, I'm sure, more so this year. But then it's making sure it's easy for them to then move back into investments as and when to benefit from the stock markets picking up again. Keeping things like that as easy as possible has got to be a good thing.
Tom, do you agree?
So I think the rule which says that you can only subscribe to one type of each version of an ISA each tax year has always seemed quite an odd one to me. I've never had anyone at HMRC or anywhere else be able to explain to me why that needs to exist. You can pay into multiple different pensions in a tax year and it works perfectly fine. You can pay into different versions of an ISA each tax year, and that's fine. So why does that rule exist? It doesn't seem to make sense. So scrapping it to me seems like a sensible way to go. And I think it also potentially paves the way for wider, more radical simplification. So if you were going to move to a world where the best bits of the existing ISA landscape were merged into a single product, then you'd want people to be able to choose multiple different versions of that product if they wanted to. So there may be a provider within that kind of consolidated world that offers a better cash rate, and there may be a provider that has a better choice of stocks and shares. And so allowing people to have that choice in a simplified world, to me would make a lot of sense. So I think the key is going to be what comes alongside this proposal, presuming that the stories that we've read are correct. If it's just that proposal in isolation, it might make a little bit of difference to a few people's lives, and it seems sensible, but you know, it's not going to particularly rock anyone's world. But if that's the kind of starting point for more radical simplification, then I think it could be a really, really positive thing.
Yeah, totally agree with that, because what I would add is, you know, going back to saying about only being able to pay into one ISA, you know, I think that's maybe an archaic rule whereby, you know, they were trying to stop people paying into, you know, because I did see this quite a bit going back, you know, sort of 15, 16 years when I started advising, and people were paying into, you know, cash and stocks and shares, as it was at the time. And so, you know, they said, well, okay, you know, I don't know why that rule was in place in the first place, but, you know, I think it was to stop them exceeding the total allowance. But yeah, it just made things more complicated, and hence why the new ISA concept for me was a good thing, where it's just say, well, yeah, just pay into one, you know, split the money between stocks and shares and cash. But yeah, we just need to sort of get back to that simpler idea. Yeah.
And we alluded to this a little bit earlier, the number of ISAs. We've got 12 million subscribing to ISAs at all. 17,000 people subscribe to the Innovative Finance ISA, which was set up by George Osborne for peer-to-peer investing. Is that an example of an ISA that you think could be put out of its misery, Tom?
Yes, potentially. I mean, it's certainly an example of why we're reaching the point where we've got a system that's so complicated that people struggle to understand it. So the Innovative Finance ISA launched because the government wanted to encourage a specific way of investing in a specific part of the market. As you say, has not particularly taken off. Quite a lot of high-risk investing, I think, going on in that part of the market as well, which concerns me. Now, clearly, if you're going to remove a product, the challenge is that you do have people investing within that product, and you need to think about what happens to them. So it's part of the problem, I think, when you launch lots of different versions of an ISA, is that the complexity has to remain to an extent, because those people are remaining in those investments, and they'll need to divest, and it's never simple. But in an ideal world, I think if the Innovative Finance ISA were no longer here, there's clearly very few people in it, it would make things a lot easier. But there's just some challenges there in transitioning from a world where we have it to a world where we don't have it, as always is the case.
What do you think, Tim?
Yeah, I mean, for me, people just didn't get it, and there's just a real lack of awareness. So, yeah, I get what Tom's saying in terms of, you know, the issue of people who are invested in it, because there's so few, like say just 17,000, it wouldn't be a big problem. But yeah, it's just, you know, say, yeah, lack of awareness. You know, I've mentioned the other ISAs, such as the LISA, as a lot of people call it, Lifetime ISA. But yeah, if only people knew it was available ISA, really, is what it should be called, because yeah, it just didn't work. But also, what didn't sit well with me is that people, you know, investing in peer-to-peer isn't something that I'd be encouraging, you know, people, my clients, to do, and it doesn't sit too well for me in terms of retail investing that, because I had a conversation with somebody when it came out, you know, 6-7 years ago, whenever it was, and you know, they said, oh well, Tim, you could lead the way with this in terms of, you know, encouraging people to, you know, be first, you know, investing into it. And I said, well, no thanks, I'll let the others be early adopters and see how it goes. And I'm glad I did, because yeah, just peer-to-peer for me just didn't sit right, and yeah, still I have that same view today.
Very sensible move, Tim, I think.
Yeah.
and you touched on the Lifetime ISA, the LISA, the LISA, whatever we call it. Yeah. Unlike the IF ISA, that has been a popular product, and many financial commentators and brokers have suggested it for people who are saving up for their first time buyers. But there's been some criticism of the fact that its rules are now a little bit outdated. Tom, do you think this is something that can be saved, but with tweaks?
So the Lifetime ISA has been a popular product. It's a really useful product for younger people, as you say, trying to get on the housing ladder. I find the fact that the property price has remained fixed at £450,000 for so long is frustrating. That clearly needs to be updated. The early exit penalty is a real frustration. I think actually the age category as well, when you think about the Lifetime ISA for basic rate taxpayers who are self-employed, actually it'd be a really good alternative to a pension, but lots of self-employed people fall outside that age range. You've also got that early exit penalty of 25%, which means if you take the money out, then it effectively acts as a 6.25% early withdrawal charge, a kind of early withdrawal charge that I think would make the FCA's eyes wince if they were looking at that in the private sector, but was apparently fine for something that was launched by the government. So I think there are ways that could be improved. So reducing that early withdrawal charge to 20% would make sense to me. Increasing the property price to align with the way the market's moved would make sense to me. Clearly, the government find itself in a reasonable financial straitjacket. So the extent to which they want to do that, the Autumn Statement, not too sure. But it wouldn't cost a huge amount of money. And if they would do that, say at the Autumn Statement or at the budget, that would be a pretty low-cost way of saying to, I guess, young first-time buyers in particular, that the government's trying to give you a helping hand.
What do you think, Tim?
So big fan of the Lisa and Lisa and whichever you want to call it. But basically, the problem with it is, as Tom's mentioned, that it's penalising people too much because, you know, this whole thing of having the £450,000 cap for buying a property just doesn't work for people in, you know, London South East, unfortunately. And so, and in fact, I was reading saying that if it had increased in line with property prices since it was introduced in 2017, it actually would be more like about 600,000 now because, you know, they've gone about 35% roughly. It hasn't kept pace with what it should be doing, but it is something that has been more popular. And a lot of my clients were early adopters and sort of I said, well, yeah, happy to be a guinea pig with this one because for me, it, you know, seems a good thing. And actually, yeah, self-employed clients as well, it has worked well for, you know, some of those, as Tom mentioned. It's penalising people too much for this 25% charge and also the 6.25% penalty as well. They should be doing is just reducing, you know, taking away the 20% bonus that people are getting and not penalising them so heavily, which is, you know, totally what they don't want firms to be doing in financial services is to, have these heavy exit penalties, yet quite ironic that they've got the biggest one going pretty much.
Yes, there has been one recent notable example of exit fees being scrapped because of the consumer duty, but that's another podcast, I think, isn't it?
go down that rabbit hole.
Yeah. One of the rumours which has been relatively persistent has been the idea of a British ISA or a Great British ISA. This was promoted a couple of times, by one or two firms, but it seems to have picked up steam and since then, and the government seems to be considering it. This is an ISA that would invest in UK equities. What do you think of this idea, Tom?
I'm naturally not particularly comfortable with it. So clearly, AJ Bell's been pushing for ISA simplification. The idea of creating potentially a new type of ISA called a British ISA feels to me like more complexity rather than more simplification. In terms of, I guess you'd need to see exactly what it looked like to know whether or not it's something that you may be supportive of or not. So I've seen some ideas bandied around suggesting that perhaps the ISA allowance could be increased by £5,000, say, and then that £5,000 would have to go to some categorised UKGB businesses. I've seen at the other extreme, which is something which I would be much more worried about, the idea that you would limit all ISA investing with tax incentives to just UK-based companies. Now, that would clearly have detrimental impact for diversification and choice for people. I think that's something that the vast majority of the financial services industry wouldn't be particularly supportive of. I think it'd be quite bad for consumers. So we'll have to see what they come out with. But we've been very keen to push to the Treasury that actually, if you're willing to think long term about this, then simplification should naturally lead to benefits for the UK economy over the long term anyway, because people tend to invest in their home country more than anywhere else. More investment should be more money coming into the UK. I don't think there's necessarily a need to either add complexity or restrict people's choices in order to get to that outcome.
Yeah, I guess investing in companies like Diageo, which sell beer all around the world, is probably not not the boost for the UK economy that people might think. Tim, what do you think of particularly on the diversification elements, I guess?
Yeah, so, I mean, for me, it's something I'm keen on. It just go against the whole simplification thing. And having that additional 5,000 allowance then is another complexity because, you know, you've got the 4,000 with the LISA, which is, you know, included in the 20,000, the current limit. And so, yeah, okay, a lot of people don't qualify for that. But, yeah. The complexity side doesn't sit that well with me. But in terms of, you know, UK investments, I think, yes, as Tom said, a lot of people, you know, especially DIY investors, self-investors, will have more of a UK bias. But, you know, the report I was reading from Bloomberg the other week was saying, you know, the UK risks a decade in the doldrums. And you know, there have been massive outflows for, you know, we've basically only seen 2 years of inflows, in fact, into UK funds, positive inflows, that is, since 2005, and that's in 2009 and 2015. And actually, we've got to a point where there's been £1 billion outflows per month from UK funds, and, you know, £44 billion and withdrawn since 2016. So you know, that it has had an impact, and you know, a lot of fund managers have almost given up on the UK stock market, and it does have an impact. You know, okay, yes, a lot of the companies in the FTSE 100 are international companies and their earnings are overseas, but yeah, it's just having confidence in the UK stock market, and especially for smaller companies, because that's where we do need the money coming in. They're the lifeblood of the UK, you know, these domestic companies whose earnings are, you know, based in the UK. So I think they're the ones who've really suffered. And that's why having more money coming in, if we can encourage that, for me, is a good thing. But the caveat being, we need to, you know, make sure it's done in a manner that is easy for people to understand.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, Tim. And I think that's the challenge with doing this through ISAs potentially, is that the government, through its Mansion House reforms, is clearly trying to push for private equity style money that is hopefully going to go to these kind of high growth unlisted companies. And I guess the challenge with ISAs is, I guess, the idea of getting money in an ISA into an unlisted illiquid investment, given what we saw happen with Woodford not too long ago. Makes me feel particularly nervous. I'm sure they're not going to go down that route, but that's obviously where the government ideally, I think, wants to go if it could. Well, do it, just it'd be far too risky prices, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's the danger, you know, that long-term assets. Okay, yeah, that's related to pensions more so. But yeah, what we don't want is something like that with ISAs, because, you know, again, you know, going back to mention with the, if ISA, as we call it now, with the peer-to-peer. Yeah, so that's, again, it's just, yeah. You know, let's stay away from that. It's, you know, a bit of a sort of red herring. We don't need those sort of anomalies, if you like, you know, muddying the water. Yeah.
And perhaps given that it's a product which is one of the purest retail products out there, perhaps the focus should be more on encouraging people to turn their cash ISAs into stocks and shares ISAs, rather than trying to get people who are already invested to invest more of their money into particular firms and companies.
Yeah, very much so, because, you know, the markets will start to pick back up at some point, and yeah, we need to make sure investors are benefit, or people are benefiting from that by investing going forwards. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Finally, on a slightly different topic, one of the rumours, fairly persistent rumours about the autumn statement, has been that there are going to be cuts to IHT. I think just the other day there was a suggestion that IHT is going to be cut from 40% to 30%, and these rumours seem to be gathering pace. But this is something which can be controversial, because relatively few people actually pay IHT. Tim, as an advisor who responsible on a day-to-day basis for planning your way around these, would a 40% to 30% cut make your life much easier?
Well, I mean, we've been flip-flopping around with this a bit because it's been bandied about just the other week that we were going to see IHT scrapped, which, say, I couldn't see happening because the government, as they now seem to have realised, they're going to lose about $6 billion in revenue from lost taxes. So, in terms of a cut, then, yeah, I think that is more likely to happen. You know, the danger with these things is, you know, the devil's always in the detail, as I say, but it's how it impacts clients. So, you know, if they'd have scrapped IHT, yeah, great. But the downside is actually clients who've planned, you know, done their planning, putting money into trust, for example, would then think, well, hang on a minute, I've given up access to that money. You know, can I now access it? And the answer would be no. So, you know, there are always unintended consequences to these things. But, you know, if it's a case of saying, well, you know, if they were to reduce the rate of IHT, then, you know, happy days, all good with me, really.
Yeah, I guess there's quite a large industry. Going back to our previous conversation, there's quite a large industry of people such as offering things like AIM ISAs that people have invested into, which are based entirely around the existence of
Exactly. IHT. That's the other thing I was thinking. Yeah, very much so. It's, you know, people are taking that additional risk, which is a level of risk that, you know, a lot of people are comfortable with, and that's fine. But yeah, again, I mean, those structures, it's a bit easier to shift your money out of those. But, you know, it's like, well, yeah, it's going to have a lot of disruption and yeah, could be a potential headache for a lot of people. Yeah.
Mm. Tom, what do you think?
Yeah, well, interestingly, on piggybacking on that point, a lot of people invest will choose to invest in pensions because they're generally free from IHT and can be passed on tax free on death as well. So you will, you know, if we move to a world where IHT was scrapped altogether, for example, then people who have made contributions to pensions, locked their money up until age 55, they may have done that thinking that actually one of the key reasons is the death benefits for pensions, and now they may be thinking, well, I could have kept that outside of the estate because IHT's been, I could have left it in the estate, sorry, because IHT's not going to be levied. I think, you know, as Tim said, the devil will be in the detail in all of this. It would seem to me easier to increase the allowance rather than cut the rate, but I think there's all of this stuff is kind of dripping in politics now, isn't it? I think you've got Rishi Sunak behind in the polls. He's looking for kind of clear blue water between himself and Keir Starmer. And it may be a calculation that, A, clearly this is going to be popular in the Conservative heartlands, and actually outside of the Conservative heartlands, lots of people, as you kind of alluded to, Damien, who aren't affected by IHT, just don't like the idea of money being taxed on death. So I think it will have wide popularity, and it's potentially a bit of a political trap for Keir Starmer, because does he support that and say, I like the idea of allowing people to pass more money on after they've worked hard all their lives, or does he say this is a tax cut for the rich at the same time as the government's potentially reducing or not increasing people's benefits by as much? I think it feels to me as much a political trap as any kind of long-term thinking, but I think that's the kind of stage of the political cycle we're at now, I think, is setting political traps and hoping other people fall into them.
Yeah, that's it. Rishi's been fishing down the back of the sofa to see what he could find. Obviously, wasn't enough there, so we thought, hang on a minute, can't get right. What else can we do? it is a case of, you know, for me, the allowances have been frozen that long. So many people have been dragged into IHT that shouldn't be paying it. That's what they should be addressing for me, you know, in addition to perhaps some other measures. But first and foremost, you know, that really needs looking into.
Yeah. Cool, great. Well, thanks very much, Tim and Tom. Thank you very much for listening. And I guess we'll find out soon enough. Tune in again next week for the next edition of the FT Advisor podcast. Thank you.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.